Okay, so welcome back. Welcome to the second half of the McGill School of Environmental Research Symposium. And in this section, we're going to have a panel discussion on bridging the gap between environmental science and policy. And this panel that I've assembled will examine the challenges of translating environmental science into action through policy. And they each have experience in the challenges of doing so. And I'm going to introduce them. And then I'm going to speak about the context and what I've asked them to comment on, and then we'll have presentations from each one of them. So our panel has consisted as follows. You met him yesterday, Dr. Norm Yan. He is a professor of biology at York University. He's one of Canada's leading aquatic biologists. He worked for the Ontario Ministry of the Environment for 25 years. Before joining York University in the year 2000, he now splits his time between York University and the Ministry of Environment's Environmental Science Center at Dorset. Next to him is Dr. David Pearson. He is a professor of earth sciences at Laurentian University. From 2001 to 2007, he was chair of the Ontario Office of the Canadian Climate Impacts and Adaptation Research Network. He is now science advisor to the Ontario Center of Climate Impacts and Adaptation Resources. From 2008 to 2010, he was co-chair of the Ontario Government's Expert Panel on Climate Change Adaptation. He also served as chair of the Science Advisory Panel for Ontario's Far North Initiative. He has also hosted two television series and a weekly radio series on science issues and has received awards for his contributions to public communication of science from the Geological Association of Canada and the Royal Society of Canada. Next to him is Dr. Nigel Roulet. He is James McGill Professor of Biogeosciences in the Department of Geography. He served as director of the School of Environment and the director of the Center for Climate Change and Global Change Research at McGill. He was a contributing author for the second, third, and fourth scientific assessments by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And you may recall that the fourth panel in 2007 of the IPCC was the joint recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. Next to him is Dr. David Green. He's professor of biology at McGill University and the director of the Redpath Museum. He served as chair of the Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada, COSEWIC, which determines the conservation status of Canadian wildlife. He also serves as a member of the Science Advisory Council for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans and the Canadian representative on the IUCN Amphibian Specialist Group. So you can see all of these people have diverse experiences dealing with policymakers and trying to influence policy through their expertise of the various aspects of science that they deal with. So they have firsthand experience on some of the challenges, some of the frustrations, and some of the gratification of actually getting policy through. Now, as you are well aware, the public has been hearing about global environmental change, which is the theme of this symposium, for a few decades now. And researchers continue to discover and report new ways in which human activities are altering ecosystems on a global scale. And we've seen examples of that yesterday. In the past, when scientists sounded the alarm, policymakers would ultimately respond. Sometimes there was a delay and there was some debate and sometimes there was rancor. But in the end, we made progress on issues such as pesticides, nutrient pollution, acid rain. For example, the discovery that products containing chlorofluorocarbons can degrade the stratospheric ozone layer led ultimately, because of a few scientists who spearheaded the way, to the Montreal Protocol in 1987. So you can see throughout the 80s, when it was discovered that the ozone layer over the South Pole was diminishing, and of course because of the threat to human health that posed, there was an alarm raised by scientists that ultimately led to a protocol to control the chemical products and a ban on the chemical products that did it. And you can see here that this may have had, we may have averted a disaster here. We don't know how long it'll take before the ozone layer will recover or if it ever will recover, but it seems to have stabilized, even though there's year-to-year fluctuation in the size of the hole over Antarctica. So this could be called tentatively a success story. Atmospheric CO2, well, that might be another story. This is the famous Keeling curve, which measures the atmospheric concentration of CO2 from the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii. It was pointed out to people at McGill by a visiting scientist, Amanda Lynch, that this concentration of CO2, which we have linked through years of research to climate change, although not without debate, has continued to rise despite the warnings by the IPCC through four successive reports. The assessment in 1990, the 1995 one, the 2001, and the 2007 that received the Nobel Peace Prize. The problem continues to increase. The interesting thing here is that we have raised the alarm on the role of fossil fuels in climate change for over 20 years, and yet progress toward implementing policies has arguably been negligible. This is a more complex challenge, admittedly, than perhaps some of the previous issues, but the science behind it has met with far more opposition, I would say. And so that raises the question, do environmental scientists have the same authority and respect that they once had, or as medical doctors still have, for example? Because my colleagues have heard me say this before. I see environmental scientists as earth doctors. Here you had, in the IPCC, you had, what was it, 1,500 of them, of some of the best earth doctors, make a diagnosis and make a prognosis and point the way forward. And it seems to me that the reaction has not translated into the kind of concrete action you would get if 1,500 doctors have made a very serious prognosis. So that leads me to wonder whether environmental scientists have the same kind of authority they once had. Now, most Canadians, except the 80%, according to some polls, accept the scientific consensus that humans are altering the Earth climate, and yet we still elect successive governments that seem to fail to treat this as a priority. And the question is why? Do policymakers and scientists find communication very difficult? And if so, why do they do so? Does the scientific community understand what policymakers want? Do policymakers understand what the scientific community is saying? Is there a more effective infrastructure to be put in place to translate our best scientific advice into policy? These are the questions that I've raised with the panel, and I've invited them to speak on their own experience and give their own opinions as to how to remedy this situation. So I will call up the first panelist, Dr. Yan. To speak on this.
I hope we can set up a cap and trade on slides here, but Nigel hasn't agreed to accept any of my slides. So, boy, this was a great challenge that Tony posed to us. I did work for 25 years for the Ministry of the Environment and certainly participated in a lot of early discussions with policymakers related to acid rain and smelter emissions in Sudbury, shoreline development, so a few of the two of the four issues that started the environmental movement in North America, eutrophication and acid rain. But as I prepared for this, I realized that Tony's raising the alarm on the complexity and perhaps the delayed response was true, and that I kind of needed a taxonomy about issue maturity, environmental issue maturity, if I was to really understand why we were successful at some times and unsuccessful at other times. And in my mind, there were three components to that concept of issue maturity, which is inspired in part by Gary Peterson, who used to be here. The concepts of how well we understand a problem, how inherently controllable that problem is, and then, critically, whether we have social consensus, societal consensus, about whether we have a real problem that's urgent enough that we needed to act on. So I want to address those issues. Here's my key assertion, and I'm way out on a limb here. So my key assertion is that all we need to solve environmental problems in a democracy is the will to act, inspired by appropriate knowledge as a guide. I place will above knowledge, in this case, hierarchically. Knowledge will contribute to will, but in addition to knowledge contributing to will, things like beliefs and experience and aspirations, also affect the will to act. And, of course, action is possible without appropriate knowledge. You might think of it as heading off in all directions, but hopefully we have the knowledge to inspire that will. The critical thing, though, is that the will to act does not come solely from the knowledge that scientists have created. So how do will and knowledge play out, given that the maturity of the environmental issue in a kind of socio-ecological economic context will vary? So here's the simplest case. and it has three attributes. The simplest case is that the societal consensus exists, that the issue is real, urgent, must be dealt with. The problem is controllable. In other words, its causes can be identified and they're attributable to us. Those causes can then be removed. And there is sufficient understanding, the diagnosis and prognosis that Tony talked about, that we can move. So how do knowledge and will play out in this case? You can come up with a simple little model of the environmental management process. You first must understand the problem, which means that you've selected indicators that reflect societal values. You develop targets that indicate you've got a problem. You have a monitoring program that compares the indicators with the targets. You then submit a report to somebody, an environmental assessment report. And then society has a chance to think about it. It might be a real report or newspaper articles or, the Canadian Society of Physicians for the Environment or someone has commented on it. And we agree that there is a problem. So the next thing we have to do is diagnose the actual from among all possible causes of that problem. As Tony said, we need prognoses. So we need to understand the cause-effect linkages well enough in space and time that we can propose action. Action has to be taken, and then scientists spring back in to do something about it. In the middle of all of this, will to act plays out. And the will to act is where policy is actually set. So it takes this balance of science and society, facts and value assessment, scientists and social scientists all working together to, in simple cases like this, where there is consensus, the problem is understandable and controllable. And this, Tony gave some examples. Here's three others. Top left is fish have returned to Clearwater Lake for the first time in 80 years because the pH has gone from 4 to 6. The return of the bald eagle to the United States because we dealt with DDT. Bottom left, I chose trees, but, that lead levels in maple trees in Toronto have fallen by 100-fold because we've dealt with tetraethyl lead. And then the example of eutrophication. These were the four issues that started the environmental movement: acid rain, DDT, lead pollution, and the first reported death of the Great Lakes in Canada. Now, what are the characteristics of these, what I'm calling case one simple cases? There was a valued ecosystem resource which was demonstrably damaged by something that we did that was attributable to what ultimately we came to realize were a few well-heeled, we can call them culprits, DDT makers, the chemical industry, the Ethyl Corporation with its tetraethyl lead, phosphate and detergent, something like that. But the critical thing is that there weren't very many of them, and we understood what they had done. And so best shot dynamics applied in an economic analysis sense, so that where a small number of well-heeled, knowledgeable culprits, and I don't mean that derogatorily, but in this case, you know what I mean, that they were responsible for the problem. and the solutions are obvious in retrospect. They certainly weren't obvious at the time. Best shot dynamics applies. And if people were sufficiently outraged, and we're going to have to return to this issue of how outrage is produced, then politicians will act and instruct their policymakers to enact policies to deal with the problem. But let's remember that it took decades. These were relatively simple cases ultimately, but they didn't get resolved quickly. There were lots of long, hard, difficult discussions. The only ones I was really involved in were the acid rain ones between Canada and the United States, and politics was very much involved. It wasn't easy, but this was the simple case. So on these two gradients of issue maturity, the feasibility of control and scientific understanding, these are ideas that really I first saw from Gary Peterson, who was here at McGill for a while. We have the upper right quadrant of this figure where feasibility of control is high and understanding is high, and we know how to solve those sorts of issues. Now, those issues weren't always in that quadrant. They usually started with poor understanding, but still high feasibility of control. And that's where we are, for example, with net pen aquaculture today. We can control net pen aquaculture. We need it. But the Dillon-Rigler-Vollenweider models don't work. We can't quite figure out what the implications are of all those fish pooping and dying in the water. And so we need some more understanding, and then hopefully net pen aquaculture will move up. So we need science, more of the diagnostic, prognostic stuff for issues like that. But those are still the simple cases, and I don't want to dwell on them. There's two more complex cases. One I'm going to call case two. where the we understand what's going to happen, but the feasibility of control is actually low, or the feasibility of predicting exactly when and where something is going to happen is low. And you can think of, you know, hurricanes or earthquakes. To some extent, we know what an earthquake or a hurricane of a certain size will do. We can't stop it. It doesn't mean we can't do stuff, though. And Tony and I have recently had a paper just came out in Bioscience that actually poses the question, might invading species be one of these case two issue maturity situations where, more like a natural disaster than like acid rain? And that has all kinds of implications. How do will and knowledge play out in this case? Assuming there is consensus again, that's a critical thing. The things we have to do are very different than, because we can't eliminate the cause. What we can do is harden the landscape to reduce the impacts. We can design better band-aids if you want. We can never get rid of the disease, but we can design much better band-aids. And here's some of the things that we could do: reduce vulnerability, focus efforts on the most vulnerable systems, develop early warning systems, develop rapid assessment, rapid response capabilities, practice emergency preparedness. We do this for fires, for floods. We should be doing it for invading species, et cetera. So these are very different actions than in the other case where we can eliminate the cause. But there is a third gradient, which is more complex and which is, I think, where maybe the focus of the discussion will come today. And I thank David for telling me I had to flip my understanding text. I learned yesterday that all text on the y-axis should be horizontal, so you don't have to turn your head sideways to... And that's the that's the consensus axis, which is, so far we've only been talking about the other two, understanding and controllability. But what about consensus? So this is the most serious one, in my opinion. So if there is no consensus about an issue, that means there's no collective will to act, and will, remember, is above knowledge. So what should we do if we have consensus, for example, on climate change? Tony's told us even 80% of Canadians believe it, and certainly more scientists believe that climate change is caused by greenhouse gas emissions than lung cancer is caused by smoking. You know, there's no real disagreement. And really our focus must shift, I think, to building consensus by becoming much more effective communicators. So let's look at the characteristics of a case three issue maturity problem by comparison to the case one ones I talked about earlier. So climate change has many causes. There's no one culprit. You know, we're kind of all responsible. There are large individual costs of applying a solution. So as opposed to best shot dynamics, weakest link dynamics apply. We rely on the people that are least able to deal with the problem for its solution. I can't tax anybody for the $20,000 that I need to put in a ground source heat pump when my furnace ages. I just recently went through that decision. You know, I'm 62 years old. I'm probably only going to be in my 200-year-old house for another 20 years. Do I want to spend 20 years? I hope so. Probably 5 years before I move to a bungalow. You know, my wife and I decided that we couldn't see our way through to spend $20,000 on a ground source heat pump. And it just didn't make sense to us. And if it doesn't make sense to me, that's really, it won't make sense to anyone. There are organized deniers that are bent on preventing consensus. And that means there are many politicians that are not yet on board, and all of that means that there's an inadequate social will to act. And scientists are in part responsible for this, and that's because our understanding of what produces will in society is incomplete at best. What we often do is predict a dire future, asking individuals to make big, costly changes in their lives. When individually no one intended harm through their actions. In fact, our mothers told us if we worked hard and went to school, you know, we lived in a just world, that everything would be better. We don't want to hear that those kinds of actions actually are harming the world. None of us, or very few of us, have actually experienced damage caused by climate change yet. Very few of us have. And experience is another one of those things that produces the will to act. People that have experienced floods are much more willing to act on climate change. I suspect that people in the Red River Valley in Winnipeg are more willing to act on climate change than other people are because they've experienced the damage caused by floods. There's no culprit except for us, and we often deliver a message that's hopeless. is it any wonder we're being ignored if that's the way we're delivering a message? So I think our message is often flawed because we rarely consider things that make us nervous. You know, when I'm interviewed by the media, I want to talk about the facts, I want to talk about trends, I want to talk about causes. But the media wants to ask me about how I feel about these things. And I always resist that because my first thought is how I feel is irrelevant, you know, to this issue. And then I'm told by the media, Dr. Yan, how you feel is the most important, you know, component of this. And scientists are not trained to think like that at all. You know, we're told that that's sloppy, shallow, miserable, irrelevant, you know. Our mothers understand it's important, you know, but our supervisors don't. And listen to your mothers is my advice. So we rarely consider beliefs, perceptions, emotions, or experience in our messaging. Rather, we rely on facts and trends and sound predictions. Now, of course, we must start there. We must have facts and trends and sound predictions. If we don't have that, we have nothing. But we must remember that beliefs matter and must be addressed. If people believe the and make these beliefs overt, people believe the world is just, you know. And it isn't always just. And sometimes you have to tell people that it's not always just. Perceptions matter. So recognize that people might have different perceptions and deal with those perceptions, at least by asking people, you know, what their perceptions are. Feelings absolutely matter. And if you give people no hope, you're toast, in my opinion. So you have to give people hope that action might work. people act if they're outraged. And what produces outrage? Well, intent is more important than outcome when it comes to outrage. well, the simplest story I heard to prove that to me is imagine one mafioso hires a hired killer to kill another mafioso from a competing gang, and he checks him out and realizes the other mafioso goes to Tim's every morning at 9:05 and buys a coffee and leaves his hitmen in the car across the street. So he's checked out what he does, and he makes a decision that he's going to kill this mafioso he's been hired to kill by gunning him down with his car on a December day in the streets of Montreal. So he lines up to do this, but he hits a patch of black ice and spins out and misses him. And the poor single mom with the two kids in the stroller in the back seat hits the same patch of ice and kills him. Who are you madder at? The woman that killed the man or the murderer that didn't? You're much madder at the hitman, even though there was no bad outcome. Intention really matters. And so I advise, if you can show not that something's changed, but there's been willful damage caused. In other words, there was a willful intent to not solve a problem that somebody knew was real. That's a much more powerful message and a way to deliver a message than not recognizing that intent and outcome both matter. Experience matters. Few have experienced climate change, so I suggest we start communicating the message by talking to people in the Red River Valley that have experienced floods and talking to people in Halifax and Vancouver that live within a few feet of sea level that I actually start to understand that they may have trouble. So we need help in communicating. So here's what we shouldn't do anymore. You know, we should recognize that dire forecasts published only in the scientific literature do not build consensus. So we must engage with society and with our social science colleagues. The school here is very well equipped to do that. Well, much to teach us. Our social science colleagues have much to teach us about how people form opinions. I just discovered a week ago that there was a whole subdiscipline of ecology called political ecology. It was humiliating to me to know I didn't even realize that subdiscipline existed. And so I'm hoping I approach you in all humility because I realize there's whole disciplines of knowledge that should inform this debate that I know nothing about, and that's amazing. It's also kind of exciting. What is political ecology? I don't know. I think there's books been written about it, but I have no idea what it is. So, number two, oppose all policies that reduce the free flow of knowledge actively. Knowledge isn't all it takes, but without knowledge, we're toast. And so whenever I see things happening that reduce the free flow of knowledge, I know we're in trouble. So we need, but in my main message is we need to communicate better. We need to unmuscle government scientists the way Obama just has. We need to break out of our academic silos. Universities are not free, free of criticism here. And we need to convince our academies to give us more credit for public discourse and interdisciplinary work. I work in a biology department that doesn't do that very well at York University. But more importantly, we need to move beyond just offering dire predictions to offering hope and solutions. If you just offer dire predictions about some future distant event that may or may not happen, people will just shut you down. So we need to become honest advocates of our knowledge. I really like Reid Noss's advice. It's not enough anymore just to be objective about our science. We have to realize that not everyone understands our science, some people. Not all opinions are equally meritorious. That's maybe a dangerous thing to say, but I believe that very strongly. Be prepared to evaluate and give advice on opinions that may differ in their underlying merit. And that we need to be humble. We need to understand that the policymakers aren't out there waiting for us to tell them what to do. They have their own ideas about what's worth doing. There's just an article that came out in the last Bioscience that has 40 issues that policy analysts think we should be working on. That's humbling to look at that and realize that there are other, you know, policymakers aren't agendaless, waiting for us to tell them what to do. And so as a biologist, I couldn't resist to end my thoughts giving you a little taxonomy, a dichotomous key of issue maturity, which recommends action. So you all know from Biology 101 what a dichotomous key is. And you also all recognize that, you know, nature hates definitions but loves concepts. So let's think of this as kind of a conceptual dichotomous key. So first thing you have to ask on those three gradients to know what to do as a scientist is there a social consensus? If there is not, then all efforts, if the scientific understanding is there, should be focused on learning and communicating and educating and marketing. Listen to Terry O'Reilly's The Age of Persuasion on CBC. Listen to Terry O'Reilly's The Age of Persuasion on CBC. If there's no social consensus, go to two in the dichotomous key. Then we're on the understanding controllability gradients. So if the issue is understood but uncontrollable, then it's like an earthquake. There's still stuff we can do, and I've listed those things there. If it's understood and controllable, that's case one. That's the simplest case. And scientists know very well what to do in that case. My last advice is to remember my favorite Canadian poet, Richard Outram. This comment from him that the cardinal human values are humility and hope. Cardinal human values are humility and hope. We have to be humble enough to realize we've often got it wrong. We have to be humble enough to realize we are not the only experts in the world, and we need many other experts to help us get our message across. We should be hopeful, though, because despair is no platform from which to solve anything. And we should also be hopeful because we have many examples where we actually have solved problems before and we can learn from those. So those are my thoughts on how to proceed at the policy science interface.